engaged against the full force of von Kluck's army. To the disgust of the forward-minded, Lanrezac refused. He remained silent, gave no orders, waited. In the controversy which critics and partisans were to weave for years afterwards over the Battle of Charleroi, everyone pronounced his own version of what went on in the soul of General Lanrezac that afternoon. To some, he appeared pusillanimous or paralyzed. To others, as a man soberly measuring the chances in an obscure and perilous situation. Left without guidance from GQG, he had to make his own decision. Late in the afternoon occurred the decisive incident of the day. Troops of Hausen's army enlarged a bridgehead across the Meuse at Onea, south of Dinan. Franchet d'Esperey at once sent a brigade under General Mangin to deal with the danger which threatened to take the Fifth Army in the rear. At the same time, word at last reached Lanrezac from General de Langle. It could not have been worse. Not only was the Fourth Army not successful in the Ardennes, as an earlier communique from GQG had implied, but it was being forced into retreat that would leave unguarded the stretch of the Meuse between Sedan and Lanrezac's right flank. At once, the presence of Hausen's Saxons at Onea took on added threat. Lanrezac believed, I was bound to believe, that this force was the van of an army that would be given liberty of action by de Langres' retreat and would be reinforced, if not immediately thrown back. He did not yet know, because it had not happened yet, that General Mangin's brigade, in a brilliant charge with fixed bayonets, would throw the Saxons out of Onea. On top of this, word came that the Third Corps, in front of Charleroi, had been attacked, had failed to hold its ground, and was falling back. Commandant Duruy arrived, with news that the Germans had taken the northern forts of Namur, and entered the city. Lanrezac returned to Corps headquarters at Chimay, where he received confirmation of the check to the Fourth Army, which since morning had been retiring in such a way as to leave the Fifth Army's right completely uncovered. To Lanrezac, the danger on his right seemed acute. The thought haunted him of that other disaster, at the very place where de Langle's army was now giving way, where 44 years ago our army was encircled by the Germans and forced to capitulate, that abominable disaster which made our defeat irretrievable. What a memory! To save France from another Sedan, the Fifth Army must be saved from destruction. It was now clear to him that the French armies were in retreat along their whole line, from the Vosges to the Sambre. As long as the armies existed, the defeat was not irretrievable as it had been at Sedan, the fight could go on. But if the Fifth Army were to be destroyed, the whole line would be unhinged and total defeat follow. Counterattack, however bravely pressed and urgent the need, could not save the situation as a whole. Lanrezac finally spoke. He gave the order for a general retreat. He knew he would be taken for a catastrophade who must be got rid of, as indeed he was. His own account tells that he said to one of his officers, "We have been beaten, but the evil is reparable. As long as the Fifth Army lives, France is not lost." Although the remark has the ring of memoirs written after the event, it may well have been spoken. Fateful moments tend to evoke grandeur of speech, especially in French. Lanrezac made his decision, which he believed Joffre would disapprove, without consulting GQG. "Enemy threatens my right on the Meuse," he reported. "Onea occupied, Givet threatened, Namur carried." Because of this situation and the delay of the Fourth Army, he was ordering the retirement of the Fifth Army. With that message vanished the last French hope of defeating the ancient enemy in a short war. The last of the French offensives had failed. Joffre did disapprove, but not that night. In the befogged and bitter hours of Sunday night, August 23, when the whole French plan was collapsing, when no one could be certain what was happening from sector to sector, when the spectre of another Sedan haunted minds other than Lanrezac's, GQG neither questioned nor countermanded the Fifth Army's retreat. By his silence, Joffre ratified the decision. He did not forgive it. Afterward, the official account of the Battle of Charleroi was to state that General Lanrezac, thinking himself menaced on his right, ordered a retreat instead of counterattacking. That was when GQG, in need of a scapegoat for the failure of Plan 17, settled upon the commander of the Fifth Army. In the hour when he made his decision, however, No one at GQG suggested to General Lanrezac that he merely thought himself menaced on his right without actually being so, as the post-war phrase implied. Far to the left, since early morning, the British and von Kluck's army had been locked in a duel over the 60-foot width of the Mons Canal. The August sun broke through early morning mist and rain, bringing promise of great heat later in the day. Sunday church bells were ringing as usual, as the people of the mining villages went to mass in their black Sunday clothes. The canal, bordered by railroad sidings and industrial backyards, was black with slime and reeked of chemical refuse from furnaces and factories. In among small vegetable plots, pastures and orchards, the grey pointed slag heaps like witches' hats stuck up everywhere, giving the landscape a bizarre abnormal look. War seemed less incongruous here. The British had taken up positions on either side of Mons. To the west, the Second Corps, commanded by General Smith Dorrien, lined the 15-mile stretch of canal between Mons and Condé, and filled in a salient formed just east of Mons, where the canal makes a northward loop about 2 miles wide and a mile and a half deep. On the right of the Second Corps, General Haig's First Corps held a diagonal front between Mons and the left wing of Lanrezac's army. The cavalry division, commanded by General Allenby, future conqueror of Jerusalem, was held in reserve. Opposite Haig was the dividing line between Kluck's and Bülow's armies. Kluck was keeping as far to the west as he could, and thus Haig's corps was not attacked in the fighting of August 23 that was to become known to history and to legend as the Battle of Mons. Sir John French's headquarters were at Le Cateau, 30 miles south of Mons. The five divisions he had to direct over a front of 25 miles, in contrast to Lanrezac's 13 divisions over a front of 50 miles, hardly required him to be that far back. Sir John's hesitant frame of mind may have dictated the choice. Worried by the reports of his air and cavalry reconnaissance, uncertain of his neighbours, uncomfortable about the zigzag line of the front they shared, which opened multiple opportunities to the enemy, he was no more happy about undertaking an offensive than was Lanrezac. On the night before the battle, he summoned the senior staff officers of both corps and the cavalry division to Le Cateau and informed them that, owing to the retreat of the French Fifth Army, the British offensive would not take place. Except for its Tenth Corps, which was not adjacent to the British, the Fifth Army was not in retreat at this time, but Sir John French had to blame someone. The same comradely spirit had moved General Lanrezac a day earlier to blame his own failure to take the offensive on the non-appearance of the British. As Lanrezac had then ordered his corps to hold the line of the Sambre instead of attacking across it, Sir John French now issued orders to hold the line of the canal. Despite Henry Wilson, who was still thinking in terms of the great offensive northward that was to throw the Germans out of Belgium, the possibility of a very different kind of movement was conveyed to the commanders. Recognizing it, General Smith Dorrien, at 2:30 a.m., ordered the bridges over the canal to be prepared for demolition. It was a sensible precaution, of the kind excluded by the French, and because excluded, because of the terrible French casualty rate of August 1914. 5 minutes before the battle opened, Smith Dorrien issued a further order directing the bridges to be destroyed on divisional order in the event of a retirement being necessary. At 6 in the morning, when Sir John French gave his last instructions to corps commanders, his, or his staff's, estimate of the enemy's strength they were about to meet was still the same, one or at most two army corps plus cavalry. In fact, at that moment, von Kluck had four corps and three cavalry divisions, 160,000 men with 600 guns, within striking distance of the BEF, whose strength was 70,000 men and 300 guns. Of von Kluck's two reserve corps, one was 2 days' march behind, and one had been left behind to mask Antwerp. At 9 a.m., the first German guns opened fire on the British positions, the attack falling first upon the salient made by the loop of the canal. The bridge at Nimy, at the northernmost point of the salient, was the focus of the attack. Lunging at it in their dense formation, the Germans offered the most perfect targets to the British riflemen, who, well dug in and expertly trained, delivered fire of such rapidity and accuracy that the Germans believed they faced machine guns. After repeated assault waves were struck down, they brought up more strength and changed to open formations. The British, under orders to offer stubborn resistance, kept up their fire from the salient, despite steadily growing casualties. From 10:30 on, the battle was extended along the straight section of the canal to the west, as battery after battery of German guns, first of the 3rd and then of the 4th Corps, were brought into action. By 3 in the afternoon, when the British regiments holding the salient had withstood shelling and infantry assault for 6 hours, the pressure on their dwindling numbers became too strong. After blowing up the bridge at Nimy, they fell back, company by company, to a second line of defence that had been prepared 2 or 3 miles to the rear. As the yielding of the salient endangered the troops holding the straight section of the canal, these too were now ordered to withdraw, beginning about 5 in the evening. At Jemappes, where the loop joins the straight section, and at Mariette, 2 miles to the west, sudden peril loomed when it was found that the bridges could not be destroyed for lack of an exploder to fire the charges. A rush by the Germans across the canal in the midst of the retirement could convert orderly retreat to a rout and might even effect a breakthrough. No single Horatius could hold the bridge, but Captain Wright of the Royal Engineers swung himself hand over hand under the bridge at Mariette in an attempt to connect the charges. At Jemappes, a corporal and a private worked at the same task for 1.5 hours under continuous fire. They succeeded and were awarded the VC and DCM. But Captain Wright, though he made a second attempt in spite of being wounded, failed. He too won the VC, and 3 weeks later was killed on the Aisne. During the early evening, the delicate process of disengagement was effected under sporadic fire, with regiment by regiment covering the withdrawal of its neighbour until all had reached the villages and billets of the second line of defence. The Germans, who appeared to have suffered equally from the day's fighting, made no serious effort to force the undemolished bridges, nor showed any appetite for pursuit. On the contrary, through the dusk the retiring British troops could hear German bugles sounding ceasefire, then the inevitable singing, then silence across the canal. Fortunately for the British, von Kluck's more than double superiority in numbers had not been made use of. Unable, because of Bülow's hampering orders, to find the enemy flank and extend himself around it, Kluck had met the British head-on with his 2 central corps, the 3rd and 4th, and suffered the heavy losses consequent upon frontal attack. 1 German reserve captain of the 3rd Corps found himself the only surviving officer of his company and the only surviving company commander of his battalion. "You are my sole support," wailed the major. "The battalion is a mere wreck, my proud, beautiful battalion, and the regiment is shot down, smashed up, only a handful left." The colonel of the regiment, who, like everyone in war, could judge the course of combat only by what was happening to his own unit, spent an anxious night. For as he said, "If the English have the slightest suspicion of our condition and counter-attack, they will simply run over us." Neither of von Kluck's flanking corps, the 2nd on his right and the 9th on his left, had been brought into the battle. Like the rest of the First Army, they had marched 150 miles in 11 days and were strung out along the roads several hours' march to the rear of the 2 corps in the centre. If all had attacked together on August 23, history might have been different. Sometime during the afternoon, von Kluck, realizing his mistake, ordered the 2 central corps to hold the British until the flanking corps could be brought up for envelopment and a battle of annihilation. Before that time, a drastic change of plan forced itself upon the British. Henry Wilson was mentally still charging forward with medieval ardor in Plan 17, unaware that it was now about as applicable to the situation as the longbow. Like Joffre, who could still insist upon the offensive 6 hours after receiving de Langle's report of disaster in the Ardennes, Wilson, even after the line of the canal had to be given up, was eager for an offensive next day. He had made a careful calculation and concluded that we had only 1 corps and 1 cavalry division, possibly 2 corps, opposite to us. He persuaded Sir John French and Murray that this was so, with the result that I was allowed to draft orders for an attack tomorrow. At 8 p.m, just as his work was completed, it was nullified by a telegram from Joffre, which informed the British that accumulated evidence now put the enemy force opposite them at 3 corps and 2 cavalry divisions. That was more persuasive than Wilson, and at once put an end to any thought of attack. Worse news followed. At 11 p.m, Lieutenant Spears arrived, after a hurried drive from Fifth Army headquarters, to bring the bitter word that General Longrezac was breaking off battle and withdrawing the Fifth Army to a line in the rear of the BEF. Spears' resentment and dismay at a decision taken without consulting and without informing the British was like that of Colonel Adelbert on learning of King Albert's decision to withdraw to Antwerp. It still colours Spears' account written 17 years later. Longrezac's retreat, leaving the BEF in the air, put them in instant peril. In anxious conference, it was decided to draw back the troops at once, as soon as orders could be drafted and delivered to the front. A delay that was to cost lives was due to the strange choice of location for Smith Dorrien's corps headquarters. They were in a modest private country house, called rather grandly the Château de la Roche, at Sars-la-Bruyère, a hamlet without telegraph or telephone communication, on a back country road difficult enough to find in the daytime, much more so in the middle of the night. Even Marlborough and Wellington had not disdained more convenient, if less gentlemanly, headquarters on the main road, one in an abbey and the other in a tavern. Smith Dorrien's orders had to be delivered by car, and did not reach him until 3 a.m., whereas Haig's First Corps, which had not been in the battle, received its orders by telegraph an hour earlier, and were able to prepare its retreat and get underway before dawn. By that time, the two German flanking corps had been brought up, the attack was renewed, and the retreat of the Second Corps, which had been under fire all day, began under fire again. In the confusion, one battalion never received its orders, and fought until it was surrounded and almost all its men were killed, wounded, or taken prisoner. Only 2 officers and 200 men got away. So ended the first day of combat for the first British soldiers to fight a European enemy since the Crimea, and the first to fight on European soil since Waterloo. It was a bitter disappointment, both for the First Corps, which had marched forward through the heat and dust, and now had to turn and march back, almost without having fired a shot, even more for the Second Corps, which felt proud of it showing against a famed and formidable enemy, knew nothing of his superior numbers or of the Fifth Army's withdrawal, and could not understand the order to retreat. It was a severe disappointment to Henry Wilson, who laid it all at the door of Kitchener and the Cabinet for having sent only 4 divisions instead of 6. Had all 6 been present, he said, with that marvellous incapacity to admit error that was to make him ultimately a field marshal, this retreat would have been an advance and defeat would have been a victory. Wilson's confidence and cheer began to wane, and Sir John French, mercurial at best, plunged into despondency. Though in France barely more than a week, the tensions, anxieties, and responsibility, combined with the iniquities of Lanzerac, and culminating in frustration on the opening day of battle, soured him on his command. He ended his report to Kitchener next day with the ominous suggestion, indicating that he'd already begun to think in terms of departure, "I think immediate attention should be directed to the defence of Havre." Havre, at the mouth of the Seine, was nearly 100 miles south of the original British landing base at Boulogne. That was the Battle of Mons. As the opening British engagement of what was to become the Great War, it became endowed in retrospect with every quality of greatness, and was given a place in the British pantheon equal to the battles of Hastings and Agincourt. Legends like that of the Angels of Mons settled upon it. All its men were valorous and all its dead heroes. The deeds of every named regiment were chronicled down to the last hour and bullet of the fight, until Mons came to shine mistily through a haze of such gallantry and glory as to make it seem a victory. Unquestionably, at Mons the British fought bravely and well, better than some French units, but no better than many others, no better than the Belgians at Hallen, or the Turcos at Charleroi, or General Mangin's brigade at Onea, or the enemy on various occasions. The battle, before the retreat began, lasted 9 hours, engaged 2 divisions, or 35,000 British soldiers, cost a total of 1,600 British casualties, and held up the advance of von Kluck's army by 1 day. During the Battle of the Frontiers, of which it was a part, 70 French divisions, or about 1.25 million men, were in combat at different times and places over a period of 4 days. French casualties during those 4 days amounted to more than 140,000, or twice the number of the whole British expeditionary force in France at the time. In the wake of Charleroi and Mons, Belgium lay coated with white dust from the shattered walls of its houses and pockmarked with the debris of battles. Muddied hay, used by the soldiers as beds, trailed in the streets along with abandoned packs and blood-stained bandages. And over all lay a smell, as Will Irwin wrote, which I've never heard mentioned in any book on war, the smell of 500,000 unbathed men. It lay for days over every town through which the Germans passed. Mingled with it was the smell of blood and medicine and horse manure and dead bodies. The human dead were supposed to be buried by their own troops before midnight, but often there were too many and there was too little time, and even less for the dead horses, whose bodies, lying unburied for a longer time, became bloated and putrid. Belgian peasants trying to clear their fields of the dead after the armies passed could be seen bending on their spades like pictures by Millet. Derelict among the bodies lay the fragments of Plan 17 and bright, broken bits of the French field regulations. The French army, henceforth, knows no law but the offensive. The offensive alone leads to positive results. Joffre, standing amid the tumbled debacle of all French hopes, with responsibility for the catastrophe resting finally upon him, with the frontiers of France breached, with every one of his armies in retreat, or fighting desperately to hold a defensive line, remained magically unperturbed. By immediately casting the blame on the executors and absolving the planners, he was able to retain perfect and unblemished confidence in himself and in France, and in so doing provide the essential and unique requirement in the calamitous days ahead. On the morning of the 24th, when, as he said, there is no escaping the evidence of the facts, he reported to Messimy that the army was condemned to a defensive attitude and must hold out, resting upon its fortified lines, and while trying to wear down the enemy, wait for a favourable occasion to resume the offensive. He set about at once arranging the lines of retreat and preparing a regrouping of his armies to form a mass capable of renewing the attack from a defensive line he expected to establish on the Somme. He had been encouraged by a recent telegram from Paleolog in St. Petersburg to hope that the Germans would at any moment have to withdraw forces from the Western Front to meet the Russian threat. And on the morrow of his own disaster, Joffre waited anxiously for a sound of the Russian steamroller. All that came through was a sibylline telegram reporting that grave strategic problems were being settled in East Prussia with a promise of further offensive operations. Next to reforming his lines, Joffre's most urgent task was to find the cause for failure. Without hesitancy of any kind, he found it in grave shortcomings on the part of commanders. A few had indeed crumbled under the awful responsibility of command. A general of artillery had to step into the place of the commander of the Third Corps in front of Charleroi when that officer could nowhere be found during the most critical phase of the battle. In the Battle of the Ardennes, a divisional general of the Fifth Corps committed suicide. Human beings, like plants, prove fallible in the presence of those ingredients that are missing in manoeuvres, danger, death, and live ammunition. But Joffre, who would admit no fallibility of plan, would permit none in men. Demanding the names of all generals who'd shown weakness or incapacity, he enlarged the list of the Limoges with ruthless hand. Acknowledging, like Henry Wilson, no error of theory or strategy, he could only ascribe the failure of the offensive, in spite of the numerical superiority which I thought I had secured for our armies, to a lack of offensive spirit. He might better have said excess than lack. At Morhange in Lorraine, at Rossignol in the Ardennes, at Tamines on the Sambre, it was not too little but too much cran that caused the French failure. In a note for all armies, issued the very day after the debacle, GQG amended lack to false understanding of the offensive spirit. The field regulations, it said, had been poorly understood or badly applied. Infantry attacks were launched at too great a distance and without artillery support, thus suffering losses from machine gun fire that might have been avoided. Henceforth, when ground was occupied, it must be immediately organized. Entrenchments must be dug. The capital error had been lack of coordination between artillery and infantry, which it was an absolute necessity to rectify. The 75s must fire at maximum range. Finally, we must copy the enemy in using airplanes to prepare artillery attacks. Whatever else were French military faults, unwillingness to learn from experience was not one of them, at least not in the realm of tactics. GQG was less quick to locate failure in its own realm of strategy, even when, on August 24, the Deuxième Bureau made a startling disclosure. It had discovered that the enemy's active corps were followed by reserve corps using the same corps number. This, the first evidence of reserve units being used in the front line, revealed how the Germans had managed to be equally strong on the right and centre at once. It did not convey to Joffre a suspicion that Plan 17 might have had a fallible basis. He continued to believe it a good plan, which had failed through poor execution. When called to testify, after the war, at a parliamentary inquiry into the cause of the catastrophe that opened France to invasion, he was asked his opinion of the pre-war staff theory that the stronger the German right wing, the better for France. "But I still think so," Joffre replied. "The proof is that our Battle of the Frontiers was planned just for that, and if it had succeeded, our way would have been open. What is more, it would have succeeded if the 4th and 5th armies had fought well. If they had, it would have meant annihilation of the whole German advance." In the dark morning of August 1914, when the retreat began, it was not the 4th so much as the 5th Army and its commander that he chiefly blamed. Although British malice, too, clustered about the head of General Lanzerac, an anonymous spokesman for the British Army ultimately declared that Lanzerac's decision to retreat instead of counterattacking on August 23 spared another Sedan. Of Lanzerac's earlier insistence on shifting the Fifth Army west of the Meuse to Charleroi, the same spokesman added, "There is no doubt that this change of plan saved the BEF and probably the French armies also from annihilation." On August 24, all that was then clear was that the French armies were in retreat and the enemy advancing with relentless force. The extent of the debacle was unknown to the public until August 25, when the Germans announced the capture of Namur with 5,000 prisoners. The news shocked an incredulous world. The Times of London had said Namur would withstand a siege of 6 months. It had fallen in 4 days. In accents of stunned understatement, it was said in England that the fall of Namur is generally recognized as a distinct disadvantage, and the chances of the war being brought to a speedy conclusion are considerably reduced. How far reduced, how distant the end, no one yet knew. No one could realize that for numbers engaged and for rate and number of losses suffered over a comparable period of combat, the greatest battle of the war had already been fought. No one could yet foresee its consequences. How the ultimate occupation of all Belgium and northern France would put the Germans in possession of the industrial power of both countries, of the manufactures of Liège, the coal of the Borinage, the iron ore of Lorraine, the factories of Lille, the rivers and railroads and agriculture, and how this occupation, feeding German ambition and fastening upon France the fixed resolve to fight to the last drop of recovery and reparation, would block all later attempts at compromise peace, or peace without victory, and would prolong the war for 4 more years. All this is hindsight. On August 24, the Germans felt an immense surge of confidence. They saw only beaten armies ahead. The genius of Schlieffen had been proved. Decisive victory seemed within German grasp. In France, President Poincaré wrote in his diary, "We must make up our minds both to retreat and to invasion. So much for the illusions of the last fortnight. Now the future of France depends on her powers of resistance." Élan had not been enough.
Chapter 15. The Cossacks are coming. On August 5, in St. Petersburg, Ambassador Paléologue of France drove past a regiment of Cossacks leaving for the front. Its general, seeing the French flag on the ambassador's car, leaned down from his horse to embrace him and begged permission to parade his regiment. While Paleolog solemnly reviewed the troops from his car, the general, between shouts of command to the ranks, addressed shouts of encouragement to the ambassador.
"We'll destroy those filthy Prussians! No more Prussia, no more Germany! William to St. Helena!"
Concluding the review, he galloped off behind his men, waving his saber and shouting his war cry, "William to St. Helena!" The Russians, whose quarrel with Austria had precipitated the war, were grateful to France for standing by the alliance and anxious to show equal loyalty by support of the French design. "Our proper objective," the Tsar was dutifully made to say with more bravado than he felt, "is the annihilation of the German army." He assured the French that he considered operations against Austria as secondary, and that he had ordered the Grand Duke, at all costs, to open the way to Berlin at the earliest possible moment. The Grand Duke, in the last days of the crisis, had been named Commander-in-Chief, despite the bitter rivalry of Sukhomlinov, who wanted the post for himself. As between the two, even the Russian regime in the last days of the Romanovs was not mad enough to choose the German-oriented Sukhomlinov to lead a war against Germany. He remained, however, as war minister. From the moment war opened, the French, uncertain that Russia really would or could perform what she'd promised, began exhorting their ally to hurry. "I entreat your majesty," pleaded Ambassador Paleolog in audience with the Tsar on August 5, "to order your armies to take an immediate offensive, otherwise there is risk of the French army being overwhelmed." Not content with seeing the Tsar, Paleolog also called upon the Grand Duke, who assured the ambassador that he intended a vigorous offensive to begin on August 14, in keeping with the promise of the 15th day of mobilization, without waiting for all his army to be concentrated. Though famous for his uncompromising, not to say sometimes unprintable, habits of speech, the Grand Duke composed on the spot a message of medieval chivalry to Joffre. "Firm in the conviction of victory," he telegraphed, "he would march against the enemy, bearing alongside his own standard the flag of the French Republic, which Joffre had given him at manoeuvres in 1912. That a gap existed between the promises given to the French and the preparations for performance was all too apparent, and may have been cause for the tears the Grand Duke was reported to have shed when he was named Commander-in-Chief. According to a colleague, he appeared entirely unequipped for the task, and, to quote his own statement on receipt of the imperial order, spent much time crying because he did not know how to approach his duties. Regarded by a leading Russian military historian as eminently qualified for his task, the Grand Duke may have wept less for himself than for Russia and the world. There was an aura about 1914 that caused those who sensed it to shiver for mankind. Tears came even to the most bold and resolute. Messimi, opening a cabinet meeting on August 5 with a speech full of valour and confidence, broke off midway, buried his head in his hands, and sobbed, unable to continue. Winston Churchill, wishing Godspeed and victory to the BEF, when taking leave of Henry Wilson, broke down and cried so that he could not finish the sentence. Something of the same emotion could be felt in St. Petersburg. The Grand Duke's colleagues were not the firmest pillars of support. Chief of Staff in 1914 was General Yanushkevich, a young man of 44 with black moustache and curly black hair, who was chiefly notable for not wearing a beard, and whom the War Minister referred to as still a child. More a courtier than a soldier, he had not fought in the Japanese War, although he had served in the same regiment of guards as Nicholas II, which was as good a reason as any for rapid promotion. He was a graduate of the Staff College, and later its commandant, had served on the staff of the War Ministry, and when war broke out had been Chief of Staff for barely 3 months. Like the German Crown Prince, he was completely under the guidance of his deputy chief, the stern and silent General Danilov, a hard worker and strict disciplinarian who was the brains of the staff. Yanushkevich's predecessor as Chief of Staff, General Jilinsky, had preferred to be relieved of that post, and had persuaded Sukhomlinov to appoint him commander of the Warsaw military district. He was now in overall command, under the Grand Duke, of the Northwest Army Group, on the front against Germany. In the Russo-Japanese War, he had served with little distinction but no positive error as chief of staff to the commander-in-chief, General Kuropatkin, and having survived that grave of reputations, had managed to remain in the upper echelons without either personal popularity or military talent. Russia had made no preparations to meet the advanced date for attack which she'd promised to the French. Improvisations had to be arranged at the last moment. A scheme of forward mobilisation was ordered, which skipped certain preliminary stages to gain several days' time. Streams of telegrams from Paris, delivered with personal eloquence by Paleolog, kept up the pressure. On August 6, the orders of the Russian General Staff said it was essential to prepare for an energetic offensive against Germany at the earliest possible moment in order to ease the situation of the French, but, of course, only when sufficient strength has been made available. By August 10, however, the proviso for sufficient strength had been dropped. Orders of that date read, "Naturally, it is our duty to support France in view of the great stroke prepared by Germany against her. This support must take the form of the quickest possible advance against Germany by attacking those forces she has left behind in East Prussia." The First and Second Armies were ordered to be in position to advance on M14, August the 13th, although they would have to start without their services of supply, which would not be fully concentrated until M20, August the 19th. Difficulties of organisation were immense. The essence of the problem, as the Grand Duke once confessed to Poincaré, was that in an empire as vast as Russia, when an order was given, no one was ever sure whether it had been delivered. Shortages of telephone wire and telegraph equipment and of trained signal corpsmen made sure or quick communication impossible. Shortage of motor transport also slowed down the Russian pace. In 1914, the army had 418 motor transport vehicles, 259 passenger cars, and two motor ambulances. It had, however, 320 airplanes. As a result, supplies, after leaving the railhead, had to depend on horse transport. Supply was hazardous at best. Testimony in trials after the Japanese War revealed bribes and graft running like a network of moles' tunnels beneath the army. When even the governor of Moscow, General Reinbot, was convicted and imprisoned for venality in letting army contracts, he still wielded enough private influence to obtain not only a pardon, but reappointment to a new post. Meeting his commissariat staff for the first time as commander-in-chief, the Grand Duke said to them, "Gentlemen, no stealing." Vodka, another traditional companion of war, was prohibited. In the last mobilization in 1904, when soldiers came reeling in and regimental depots were a mess of drunken slumbers and broken bottles, it had taken an extra week to straighten out the confusion. Now, with the French calling every day's delay a matter of life or death, Russia enacted prohibition as a temporary measure for the period of mobilization. Nothing could have given more practical or more earnest proof of loyal intention to meet French pleas for haste. But with that characteristic touch of late Romanov rashness, the government, by UKs of August 22, extended prohibition for the duration of the war. As the sale of vodka was a state monopoly, this act at one stroke cut off a third of the government's income. "It was well known," commented a bewildered member of the Duma, "that governments waging war seek by a variety of taxes and levies to increase income. But never since the dawn of history has a country in time of war renounced the principal source of its revenue." In the last hour of the 15th day, at 11 p.m. on a lovely summer evening, the Grand Duke left the capital for field headquarters at Baranovichi, a railroad junction on the Moscow to Warsaw line, about midway between the German and Austrian fronts. He and his staff and their families gathered in subdued groups on the station platform in St. Petersburg, waiting for the Tsar to come to bid farewell to the commander-in-chief. However, the Tsarina's jealousy overrode courtesy, and Nicholas did not appear. Goodbyes and prayers were spoken in low voices. The men took their places in the train in silence and departed. Behind the front, the struggle to assemble armies was still in process. Russian cavalry on reconnaissance had been probing German territory since the first day of the war. Their forays succeeded less in penetrating the German screen than in providing an excuse for screaming headlines in German newspapers and wild tales of Cossack brutalities. As early as August 4, in Frankfurt, on the western edge of Germany, an officer heard rumors that 30,000 refugees from East Prussia were coming to be accommodated in that city. Demands to save East Prussia from the Slavic hordes began to distract the German general's staff from the task of trying to concentrate all military effort against France. At dawn, on August 12, a detachment of General Rennenkampf's First Army, consisting of a cavalry division under General Gurko, supported by an infantry division, opened the invasion of East Prussia ahead of the main advance and took the town of Margrabova 5 miles inside the frontier. Shooting as they rode through the outskirts and into the empty market square, the Russians found the town undefended and evacuated by German troops. Shops were closed, but the townspeople were watching from the windows. In the countryside, the inhabitants fled precipitously ahead of the advancing squadrons before there was any fighting, as if by prearrangement. On the first morning, the Russians saw columns of black smoke rising along their line of march, which, on approach, were discovered to be not farms and homes burned by their fleeing owners, but dumps of straw burned as signals to show the direction of the invaders. Everywhere was evidence of the Germans' systematic preparation. Wooden watchtowers had been built on hilltops. Bicycles were provided for local farm boys of 12 to 14 who acted as messengers. German soldiers posted as informers were found dressed as peasants, even as peasant women. The latter were discovered, presumably in the course of non-military action, by their government-issue underwear. But many were probably never caught, it being impossible, General Gurko regretfully admitted, to lift the skirts of every female in East Prussia. Receiving General Gurko's reports of evacuated towns and fleeing population, and concluding that the Germans were not planning a serious resistance so far east of their base on the Vistula, General Rennenkampf was the more eager to dash forward and the less concerned about his incomplete services of supply. A trim, well-set-up officer of 61, with a direct glance and energetic moustache turned up at the corners, he had earned a reputation for boldness, decisiveness, and tactical skill during service in the Boxer Rebellion as commander of a cavalry division in the Russo-Japanese War and as leader of the punitive expedition to Chita, which ruthlessly exterminated the remnants of the Revolution of 1905. His military prowess was slightly shadowed by German descent and by some unexplained imbroglio which, according to General Gurko, left his moral reputation considerably damaged. When in coming weeks his strange behaviour caused these factors to be recalled, his colleagues nevertheless remained convinced of his loyalty to Russia. Disregarding the cautions of General Jelinski, commander of the Northwest Army Group, who was pessimistic from the start, and hastening the concentration of his 3 army corps and 5.5 cavalry divisions, Rennenkampf opened his offensive on August 17. His first army of some 200,000 men crossed the frontier along a 35-mile front split by Romintern Forest. Its objective was the Insterberg Gap, a distance of 37 miles from the frontier, or about 3 days' march at the Russian rate. The gap was a stretch of open land about 30 miles wide, lying between the fortified area of Königsberg to the north and the Masurian Lakes to the south. It was a country of small villages and large farms, with unfenced fields and wide ranges of view from the occasional swells of high ground. Here the First Army would come through and engage the main German strength, until Samsonov's Second Army, turning the lake barrier from the south, would arrive to deliver the decisive blow upon the German flank and rear. The 2 Russian armies were expected to join in a common front in the area of Allenstein. General Samsonov's objective line, on a level with Allenstein, was 43 miles from the frontier, about 3.5 or 4 days' march if all went well. Between his starting point, however, and his goal were many opportunities for the unexpected hazards, what Clausewitz called the frictions of war. Owing to the lack of an east-west railway across Russian Poland to East Prussia, Samsonov's army could not cross the frontier until 2 days behind Rennenkampf's, and would already have been on the march for a week before reaching the frontier. Its line of march was along sandy roads, through a waste of undeveloped country spotted with forests and marshes and inhabited by a few poor Polish peasants. Once inside hostile territory, there would be few resources of food and forage. General Samsonov, unlike Rennenkampf, was new to the region and unfamiliar with his troops and staff. In 1877, at the age of 18, he had fought against the Turks. He was a general at 43. In the Russo-Japanese War, he too had commanded a cavalry division. Since 1909, he had been in semi-military employment as governor of Turkestan. Aged 55 when the war broke out, he was on sick leave in the Caucasus and did not reach Warsaw and Second Army headquarters until August 12. Communication between his army and Rennenkampf's, as well as to Jelinski's headquarters in the rear, which was to coordinate the movements of both, was erratic. Precision in timing was not in any case a notable Russian virtue. Having played out the campaign in war games in April before the war, with most of the same commanders and staffers were to take the field in August, the Russian general staff was gloomily conscious of the difficulties. Although the war games, in which Sukhomlinov played the role of commander-in-chief, revealed that the First Army had started too soon, when war came the same schedule was adhered to without change. Counting 2 days for Rennenkampf's head start and 4 days for Samsonov's march, there would be a period of 6 days during which the German army would have to face only one Russian army. On August 17, General Rennenkampf's two cavalry corps, guarding his flanks on right and left, had orders not only to screen his advance, but to cut both branches of the railway in order to prevent the withdrawal of German rolling stock. Having deliberately used a railroad gauge different from the German as a defense against invasion, the Russians could not bring up their own rolling stock or use the invaluable network of railroads in East Prussia unless they captured German trains. Naturally, the Germans left little rolling stock behind to be captured. The Russian army, moving farther and farther from its base into hostile country, began almost at once to outrun its horse-drawn and not fully organized supply train. For communication, lacking the wire to lay their own lines, the Russians were dependent on German telegraph lines and offices, and when these were found destroyed, they resorted to sending messages by wireless in clear, because their divisional staffs lacked codes and cryptographers. Little reconnaissance or artillery spotting was accomplished by airplane, most of the Air Force having been sent to the Austrian front. At sight of an airplane, the first they had ever seen, Russian soldiers, regardless of its identity, blazed away with their rifles, convinced that such a clever invention as a flying machine could only be German. The enlisted soldier consumed quantities of black bread and tea, which were said, though it is not easy to see why, to give him a characteristic odour rather like that of a horse. He was armed with a four-edged bayonet, which, when mounted on a rifle, made a weapon as tall as a man, and in hand-to-hand combat gave him an advantage over the German. In firepower and fighting efficiency, however, German preponderance in artillery made two German divisions equal to three Russian. The Russian disadvantage was not helped by the mutual hatred of Sukhomlinov as war minister and the Grand Duke as commander-in-chief, especially as liaison between front and rear was bad enough and the problem of supply worse. Before the fighting was a month old, the shortage of shells and cartridges was already so desperate, and the indifference or lethargy of the war ministry so discouraging, that on September 8 the Grand Duke was driven to appeal directly to the Tsar. On the Austrian front, he reported, operations would have to be held up until stocks of shells reached 100 per gun. At present, we have only 25 per gun. I find it necessary to request Your Majesty to hasten the shipment of shells. The cry, Cossacken kommen, the Cossacks are coming, echoing out of East Prussia, weakened Germany's resolve to leave the province with only a minimum defense. The 8th Army in East Prussia, consisting of 4.5 corps, one cavalry division, garrison troops of Königsberg, and some territorial brigades, was about equal in numbers to either one of the two Russian armies. Its orders from Moltke were to defend East and West Prussia, but not to allow itself to be overwhelmed by superior forces, or to be driven into the fortress camp of Königsberg. If it found itself threatened by greatly superior forces, it was to withdraw behind the Vistula, leaving East Prussia to the enemy. Such orders contained psychological dangers for weak characters, in the opinion of Colonel Max Hoffmann, who is now Deputy Chief of Operations for the Eighth Army. The weak character Hoffmann had in mind was the Eighth Army's commander, Lieutenant General von Prittwitz und Gaffron. As a court favourite, Prittwitz had enjoyed a career of rapid promotions, because, according to a fellow officer, he knew how to get the Kaiser's ear at table with funny stories and salacious gossip. Now 66 years old and notorious for his girth, he was a German version of Falstaff. Impressive in appearance, conscious to the highest degree of his self-importance, ruthless, even coarse, and self-indulgent. Known as Der Dicke, Fatty, he was without intellectual or military interests and never moved if he could help it. In vain, Moltke, who considered him unfit for his assignment, had tried for years to remove him from the designated command of the Eighth Army. Prittwitz's connections were proof against his efforts. The best Moltke could do was to appoint his own deputy, Count von Waldersee, as Prittwitz's chief of staff. In August, Waldersee, suffering from the after-effects of an operation, was, in Hoffmann's opinion, not up to par, and since Prittwitz never had been, this left Hoffmann in the happy assurance that real power to direct the Eighth Army lay in the hands of the best qualified person, himself. Anxiety for East Prussia became acute when, on August 15, Japan declared for the Allies, freeing a large number of Russian forces. In making or keeping friends, a task that forever eluded it, German diplomacy had failed again. Japan had her own ideas of her best interest in a European war, and these were well understood by their intended victim. "Japan is going to take advantage of this war to gain control of China," foretold President Yuan Shikai. As it proved, Japan used the opportunity of the war, while the European powers were too busy to stop her, to impose the 21 demands on China and to make the incursions into Chinese sovereignty and territory which were to twist the history of the 20th century. To start with, the immediate effect of Japan's joining the Allies would be to release Russian forces from the Far East. Conjuring up visions of added Slavic hordes, the Germans now had new cause to be nervous about leaving East Prussia to be held by the lone Eighth Army. From the beginning, General von Prittwitz was having trouble controlling the commander of his First Corps, General von François, a bright-eyed officer of Huguenot ancestry, 58 years old, who looked not unlike a German Foch. The First Corps was recruited from East Prussia, and its commander, determined that not one Slav should tread on Prussian soil, threatened to upset Eighth Army strategy by advancing too far. Based on Hoffmann's calculations, the Eighth Army expected Rennenkampf's army to advance first, and anticipated meeting it in battle on August 19 or 20 in the area of Gumbinnen, about 25 miles from the Russian frontier, before it reached the Insterburg Gap. 3.5 corps, including François's First Corps and a cavalry division, were sent to meet it, while the Fourth Corps was sent southeast to make contact with Samsonov's approaching army. On August 16, Eighth Army headquarters moved forward to Bartenstein, closer to the Insterburg front, where it was discovered that François had already reached and passed Gumbinnen. He believed in taking the offensive at once, whereas Hoffmann's strategy was to let Rennenkampf's army come as far west as it could on its first 2 days' march, on the theory that the farther it advanced from its base, the more vulnerable it would be. Hoffmann did not want it halted, but on the contrary allowed to reach the Gumbinnen area as soon as possible, so as to give the Germans time to engage it alone before having to turn to face Samsonov. François's advance beyond Gumbinnen, where he had established his headquarters on August 16, threatened to pull the rest of the Eighth Army after him to support his flanks, thus extending itself beyond its powers. Prittwitz, on the 16th, peremptorily ordered him to halt. François indignantly protested by telephone that the nearer to Russia he engaged the enemy, the less risk to German territory. Prittwitz replied that a sacrifice of part of East Prussia was unavoidable, and dispatched a written order reminding François that he was sole commander and again prohibiting further advance. François ignored it. At 1 p.m. on August 17, Prittwitz, to his great astonishment, received a message from François that he was already in action in Stolypinen, 20 miles beyond Gumbinnen and only 5 miles from the Russian frontier. That morning, when Rennenkampf's army crossed the frontier in full force, his third corps in the center began its march, more by lack of coordination than by design, several hours ahead of the other two. Russian reconnaissance having located François's forces at Stolypinen, orders were given to attack. Battle was joined a few miles east of the town. General von François and his staff were watching the progress of the fight from the steeple of the Stolypinen church, when, in the midst of this nerve-wracking tension, the church bell suddenly tolled with appalling sound upon their eardrums. The steeple shook with its vibrations, the telescope trembled on its tripod, and infuriated officers let loose a hail of Teutonic oaths upon the head of the unfortunate town councilman, who had felt it to be his duty to warn the people of the Russians' approach. Equal fury raged at 8th Army headquarters on receipt of the message from François. He was ordered by telephone and telegraph to break off action, and a major general was rushed off in person to confirm the order. Climbing to the belfry, in no less bad temper than already raged there, he shouted at General von François, "The General-in-Chief orders you to stop the battle instantly and retire upon Gumbinnen!" Furious at the tone and manner, François grandiloquently retorted, "Inform General von Prittwitz that General von François will break off the engagement when he has defeated the Russians." Meanwhile, a German brigade with 5 batteries of artillery had been sent around from the German right flank to attack the Russians from the rear. As the early advance of the Russian Third Corps, especially of its 27th Division, which was now engaged at Stolypinen, had opened a gap between itself and the neighbouring Russian corps on its left, it was unprotected from the German attack. The regiment upon whom the German attack fell broke and fled, involving the whole 27th Division in retreat and leaving 3,000 prisoners to the Germans. Although the rest of Rennenkampf's army reached the objective line laid down for it that day, the 27th Division had to retire to the frontier to reform, holding up the scheduled advance for the following day. Brimming with victory, François retired that same night toward Gumbinnen, after evacuating Stolypinen, personally convinced of the virtues of disobedience. Despite the check, Rennenkampf's army renewed its advance. But as early as August 19, it had begun to feel the drain of incomplete services of supply. Hardly 15 miles from their own frontier, corps commanders reported supplies not coming up and messages not getting through to each other or to army headquarters. Ahead of them, roads were clogged by massive, milling droves of cattle and sheep herded by the fleeing populace. The flight of the people and the retrograde movement of François's corps caused Rennenkampf and his superior General Jelinski, commander of the Northwest Front, to believe that the Germans were evacuating East Prussia. This did not suit the Russians, for if the German army retired too soon, it would escape destruction by the Russian pincers. Rennenkampf consequently ordered a halt for the 20th, less because of his own difficulties than to entice the enemy forward into battle and allow more time for Samsonov's second army to come up for the decisive blow upon the German rear. General von François was more than willing. With battle in his nostrils once more, he telephoned General von Prittwitz at 8th Army headquarters on the 19th and clamoured for permission to counterattack instead of continuing his retreat. It was a golden opportunity, he asserted, because the Russian advance was loose and scattered. He described feelingly the flight of the inhabitants and passionately urged the shame of yielding the soil of Prussia to the horrid footprint of the Slav. Prittwitz was torn. Intending to fight behind Gumbinnen, the 8th Army had well-prepared positions along the river Ongerop. But von François's too early advance had upset the plan, and he was now some 10 miles on the far side of Gumbinnen to the east. To allow him to attack there would mean to accept battle away from the line of the Ongerop. The other 2.5 corps would be pulled away with him and would be separated further from the 20th Corps, sent to watch the approach of Samsonov's army from the south and which might need support at any time. On the other hand, the spectacle of a German army retiring without serious battle, even if only for 20 miles, especially in full view of a terrified population, was distasteful. The decision was made more difficult when the Germans intercepted Rennenkampf's order to halt. The order was sent to Russian corps commanders by wireless in a simple code, which a German professor of mathematics attached to the 8th Army as cryptographer had no difficulty in solving. This raised the question, how long would Rennenkampf halt? The time in which the Germans would be free to fight one Russian army without the other was running short. By that evening, 3